Yes, this is Tom Kramer. I'm substituting for Julie. Julie Bernard used to be the KBOO host, and now I'm substituting for Ava Lake, who replaced Julie Bernard. But anyway, this show did get started through Julie Bernard, so I want to always commend her efforts. And thank you, Ava, for asking me to host for you again. This is Tom Kramer and KBOO 90.7, and today I have a very special guest. I'm having a Rick Scott, who is an incredibly amazing sign painter in Portland, Oregon, mainly Portland, Oregon, but he has also done signs all over the place. He's also known as Mr. Fine Sign, and I decided to have him on mainly because I've noticed more and more around town the ever sort of prevalence of signs as a ubiquitous art form. In many ways, it's really the first sort of front line of how a lot of people process visual information, and how I'm also, and we are also fascinated with the language of typography and the language of fonts. Anyway, before any further introduction, I'd like to introduce Rick Scott. Thank you for being on, Rick.
Oh, I appreciate being here.
Yeah, and I made a studio visit the other day at Rick's place, and he showed me around. It was just really fascinating to see somebody else's working methods, and also I noticed how you were able to, for example, you were talking about how a client would come up to you and say, well, you know, this is my business, how do I make a sign that sort of correlates with what they want to transact in their business? Now, that's part of your job, isn't it, helping them figure out? I mean, do you work directly, do you kind of do what the client wants, or do you kind of come up with original designs on your own?
I'd say about 75-80% of the time I design the logos and the signs.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes maybe 20-25% of the time they'll just say, here's a stat, this is our logo, we want to reproduce exactly like this.
Right.
They want to keep consistency with what they have. You know, that was like the signs at Paragon were like, they wanted a certain look that they'd had, and they want to keep that.
Right. I do want to add, everybody, Rick just mentioned he did the Paragon Cafe, and that's in the Pearl, is that right?
Yeah, it's right. I think it's on Hoyt.
It's fascinating to me looking at your different signs. He's also done Laughing Horse Bucks, the Cricket Cafe, Patty's Irish Bar. One of the more famous ones is the Veritable Quandary. Let's talk about another one you did, Duger's Market, for example. It's really a great one because it reminds me of like 1940s noir. It has a kind of a slightly retro quality. And then let's fast forward to another one you did called Pollywog. That has kind of a Northern California kind of Joni Mitchell-ish quality that I really like. And then one other example of the diversity of your sign painting ability. That's what I really admire about you, your lack of monoculture, your willingness to go all over the map in terms of the kind of lettering you use and all that. Another one I really admire is called Butterscotch. It has kind of a 1962 Jackie O kind of utopian quality that I really
like. You're seeing more in it than I am.
Well, no, I mean, what's fascinating to me, if we've many people out there have probably seen that movie about Helvetica, about the type, the kind of prevalence of or kind of preference for that kind of type. And what I like about what you're doing is that your signs are all over the map. You know what I mean? Some of them look very Art Nouveau. Some of them very Art Deco. Some of them, you know, kind of Haight-Ashbury, which, by the way, are rooted in Art Nouveau. So anyway, let's talk about that. How do you come up with, I know that's a very generalized question, but how do you, you know, segue your aesthetic with the client's, what the client wants to do?
Well, you're right. There are a lot of really uninspired signs out there and a lot of computer cut graphics that are pretty cut and dried. But I listen. You know, you listen. And,
right.
And that works sometimes. But a lot of times these people that are opening businesses don't know what they want. You know, you got to tell them. And they don't know a lot about visual. They don't know a lot about the visual language and what makes things pop, as they say in the trade, or makes them really visual, like so they can be seen from a distance and so that they stand out from the clutter all around. So I try to design a sign that first of all, it's very easy to see. Like that Dugo sign had really buxom fat letters. They were really bold and a high contrast of colors. You know, the contrast and the colors makes for visual clarity. You know, they're easier to see. And, you know, and then I just kind of think about style after that. I guess to put it real simple, I try to make the sign visible and easy to see and decipher, and then I try to make it memorable. If you can put something in it that's unique and different, either from style or some kind of whimsy or something ironic, or if you just use the best of your craftsmanship and ability, that'll make it memorable too. But that is always going to be useful or beneficial for the people that are opening up a small business. And, you know, I try to play on that and tell them that, like, if it's a restaurant and you're competing with a lot of franchises and corporate places, and they have to be the same everywhere. It's like cookie cutter, welcome to the United States of Generica, and they're always the same. They're very predictable. And I tell the people that what you have, you don't have, you know, a $5 million advertising budget, and you don't have TV and radio ads, but you have serendipity. You can be different. You can be unique. You don't have to be predictable, and that's something you should use to your advantage. Because you're small, you can be flexible.
Yeah, I completely – I see that in your work, and that's, in fact, how I tracked you down, by noticing somebody around this town is doing these amazing signs. Who is it? And I ask a few questions, and I finally tracked Rick Scott down, Mr. Fine Sign, who's now on the radio. I also got many good tips from Rick. And tell me how you got your start, how you started out, in how you segued into sign painting. I'm fascinated by that.
Oh, that just happened. It was kind of a happenstance. I had been, this was years ago, I was just a young, like I was in my early 20s, and I was just hitchhiking around the South.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was up around Louisiana. I kind of wanted to go. I had been working before that on the tuna boats out of Astoria in Oregon, and had worked on the ocean, and I was going to go and try to work on the shrimpers.
Right.
And it was like too cold. And so I went down to Florida. Everybody said, go down to Florida. That's where the boats are. And I was down there just kind of knocking around and sleeping on the beach and sleeping up behind the mini mart and all this, and on the boats around the docks there. And I ran into this guy named Lee Arthur, who had a little sign shop. And I was out there sketching. I have a passion for this. So I always carried a sketchbook with me. It was like something I loved to do. And I wanted to do it because it was like I was, you know, it's like the more you're into it, the more you're into it. So I didn't want it to be something special I did somewhere. I just wanted it to be something I did all the time, good or bad, just do it. And so he saw me sketching in Florida on the beach, and he said, hey, you like to draw? I draw too. And he said, let me see your drawings. And I said, okay. So I gave him my sketchbook, you know. And he said, hey, I like this. This is good. And he says, you ever think about getting into sign painting or working in you know, working big on billboards and all that? And I said, no, I never thought of that at all. And he said, well, why don't you come to my house tonight? So he invited me to his place. He had this shop along the bayou there. And, yeah, he was, you know, he was just kind of course I wanted to make friends with him. You know, he took an interest in me. And I went there, and his girlfriend, Becky, fixed me this big dinner. And we sat down and talked. And he said he wanted to take me on and teach me, because he was kind of obsessed with fishing. He was always going up the bayou trying to catch snook. He wanted to catch these fish. But anyway, I just sort of fell in with these people. They were really, really sweet. He was like a good old boy, easygoing. And Becky, his girlfriend, was just, you know, she was just a real good-hearted woman and a good cook, too. So I stayed there, and it was frustrating. I was trying to learn this, and just off the cuff, and it just sort of landed in my lap. And you know, I'd be frustrated and just about ready to break the brush or something. He'd come through and go, hey, that looks better. You're getting better. You know, and just at the right times, I remember him saying that, keep at it. I think it's improving, you know. And so because these people had a certain amount of joie de vivre about them, and they were interesting and kind of quirky and fun, I just stuck with it. And he taught me, and then we started going out getting jobs and working from there.
Well, that really stands out. Your work really stands out. And one thing you brought up, it's interesting because you said prior to the sign painting, when you got into sign painting, you were started out by your love of drawing. And one thing I've always emphasized to just about everybody is that drawing still is the foundation of all the visual arts, whether it be stage sets, sign painting, actual painting, architecture, sculpture. Everything sort of comes from drawing. And you showed me many of your sketchbooks. This guy has massive boxes and boxes full of different signage ideas. And one of the things I really got off on were the fact that many sign painters out there use pre-existing fonts, whereas Rick sometimes, and you've even admitted to me that you've invented some of your own letter styles that are very unique to you. And the other thing that fascinates me is how you are able, free-handed, to symmetrically lay out the lettering in such a way that you don't even require a grid structure underneath. And I don't know how you do that. It's just
I don't think about it too much. I just do it because it's something that after a while you just become good at from practice and from doing it.
Right.
And it's kind of like I think it was Lee Littlewood, maybe he said he's another one of the signsters in town. There's a sort of clique of really, you know, talented and resourceful people that do signs and kind of live that life of freelance land or live by deals or whatever you want to call it. And we kind of help each other out and know each other. And he's kind of one of the the center of this group of people that are really passionate about visual arts and signage and that. And anyway, he said something like, the more of me, the less of God. And that means like the more you think about this, like when I was starting out, I think, oh, that's not right. I didn't quite get that right. It's not perfect enough. And the more you think about it, the harder it is to do it. It's like if somebody's shooting a basket and he's saying, well, let me see, I'm 18 feet from the hoop and I'm at this angle and he's not going to make that shot. It's just something you do, you know, it just happens. And that's the same with lettering. Or like if somebody's playing a guitar or a piano or something, if they're thinking, well, I got to pluck this and strum that, it's not going to have the same kind of fluid quality or the same kind of rhythm that it would if you just do it. And that only comes from practice.
I think
you get to the point where if you do it long enough, it becomes like your muscles get so used to doing it in a certain way that you don't have to think about it. You let your muscles and your kind of unconscious or the part of you that just knows from doing this. It's kind of like riding a bike. You don't think about, am I balanced and everything. It just becomes second nature.
Right. It's like thinking gets in the way of doing in a weird way. It's sort of like a Zen concept in some way. It's like sometimes people get that feeling when they're exercising or hiking, or everybody does it differently, of course, but or meditation or whatever, or getting way into your work to the point where you're forgetting your time is irrelevant and disappears. Sort of like an Alan Watts kind of exploration in that sense. Alan Watts was a famous teacher of Zen and Eastern religions. But anyway, let's talk a little bit about some of the materials that you use, if you don't mind. I'm curious because there is one of the ways I originally met Rick was I was painting a car, a BMW, on the park blocks. And do you remember that when you stopped by?
Yeah, I remember that.
And he gave me this.
It was very,
well, anyway,
very visual. It's hard to forget that car.
Anyway, thanks. But it was really, he gave me the best advice, which was, you know, you need to put a little bit of linseed oil in the paint. And I did the next day, and the paint was like twice as fluid. So in addition to the kind of mindset we were just talking about, you were talking about prior to this conversation, what we're talking about now, what kind of materials kind of aid in your, I mean, like, let's say there's a particular coffee shop or whatever, and they say, we want this kind of look, and then you say, well, what is the range of materials you work with in your work, generally? Have you ever done, like, neon?
I worked in a neon shop for a while.
Oh, wow, I didn't know that. And that's very technical, right?
It's hot in the summer.
Uh-huh.
And it was a circus. There were all these different guys working there, coming in and out and, you know, going on installs. And they made billboards, and we we would paint these, lay out a grid pattern and paint these billboards on 4x8 sheets of plywood, and we would paint them, and then the installers would come and pick them all up and put them on the truck and then put them on stringers and reassemble them as a billboard. And you never really quite saw it all in one piece until you happen to drive by and see the billboard. But I made the patterns for it. They would bend the neon. I didn't actually bend the neon, but I was in this hot shop there, and I would make all the patterns, and you would draw the patterns for the lettering, and then the guys bending the neon would, like, they'd bend the tubing, and then they'd put it up against your pattern, and then they'd pull it off and bend it a little more and heat it up until it would conform with the curves and the, you know, the angles that you made for the lettering mm-hmm. on the pattern.
Do you ever have situations where you will design a sign, but then you'll take it over, have it done in neon by somebody else? Or are you the kind of person that likes to do all the steps yourself?
I had a guy that was doing neon for me for a while, but then you know how, you know, the world is, it's not a perfect world. And
right.
I think he went off the deep end and uh-huh. he got into drugs or something. Uh-huh. He became very unreliable, and that right. cost me, I had a lot of splaining to do.
That can be a sign of
because he didn't do it. He didn't show up.
Right.
So I just, that didn't work so good. It would be nice. If I looked around, I could probably find another guy to do neon, but.
One of the things I've noticed is
I network with uh-huh. a lot of these people in this loop of, you know, other sign painters. And, you know, we actually know people from Corvallis and the Coast and Eugene and Washington that all, you know, we kind of come together sometimes and have meetings and talk about signs and design and all. And, you know, we usually have a raison d'etre or some sort of a project to do. Like, maybe we'll go to Pete's shop and the project will be doing smaltz backgrounds or gold leaf techniques or carving, you know, techniques for carving and all. And it's not just a bunch of guys drinking beer. We actually try to, you know, it's good. We're trying to kind of big up the trade and learn from each other.
Right.
I feel very lucky to be in a loop with these guys are pretty talented.
Well, it's good to have a, you know, a support system and have, you know, allies in your
business. Well, they all have a real passion and a love for it. I see some of these guys that are really, they're really jazzed about this. They really, like Pete, sometimes he looks like this, you know, he can be really serious and he's very pragmatic about business because there's that end of it too, which is a whole different topic. But sometimes I see his, you know, he's like, his eyes are dancing like a kid on Christmas morning because he's so excited about, you know, gold leaf techniques and different applications of signage and graphics and all that. So, you know, there's a joy in it.
Right, right. One of the reasons I really admire you and what you do is I think it's on a sort of political level, it's like a sort of a front line against monoculture and against the kind of corporate takeover of design in a sense. And, you know, you go to many places around the world and everything looks the same. You know, here's the Starbucks, here's the, you know, this restaurant and that restaurant, and it looks exactly like it does everywhere else. And one thing that your signs in their own small way do is to create a kind of visual reality where we're specifically in, you know, this place called Portland, Oregon. And I want to add that, you know, my trips to Europe, for example, when you're in the Austrian or Swiss Alps, you see these ancient old hand-carved wooden signs with a cask of beer and a deer head or whatever, and you really feel like you're in a specific place. Or, you know, I had never been to rural England, but I've heard about amazing signs that exist there. Or what I'm talking about is a, in the best sense of the word, a sense of almost regionalism.
Like, that's true. I was just talking to I called a couple of other, you know, the signsters, sign painters that I know, and said, I'm going to be on the radio. What am I going to talk about? And they said, well, talk about how, you know, this does kind of show regionalism, that there are regional styles. Like there's a Northwest style of different types of scripts and different types of lettering that's different from the way they do it in Arizona or Kansas. You know, there are regional qualities or styles.
Can you describe, can you sort of get to what that is, what distinguishes this region from other regions, or is that hard to pin
down? It's just different types of script and different types of lettering applications. And then there are certain icons about the Northwest, you know, like the salmon or Mount Hood or, you know, the forest, the coast, you know, that would be different than if you were in the Midwest with a whole different, like, geography. Right. But I hear what you're saying. I've thought about that a lot, where you can be standing on the corner of 82nd and some other street, and you don't know whether you're in Phoenix or Dallas or Denver. You know, it's like, welcome to the United States of generic. And I thought about it. You know, I was in Colorado Springs a few months back, and I looked at it over, and I think the best I could call it after thinking about it, I call it affluent desolation. You know, it's just like,
right,
it's soulless. There's nothing that really speaks of, there's no humanity. There's nobody that really, really has this something refreshing or new. It's just the same corporate logos that you can see anywhere. And that's
problem with,
if you're going to tear down the forest and you're going to destroy the mystery or delete the wonder of life and live in this man-made environment at one time. And, you know, if you look at old Portland, what they built in the 1890s. And
unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah, they had a lot of ornamentation and filigree on the buildings and a lot of class and a lot of expression. And it wasn't just prefab, cheap
styrofoam.
Yeah,
made for a quick
condos
buck.
They built down the street from where I live, I mean, they look like the backside of your TV set. It's just like, I mean, how much?
Yeah, a lot of the stuff.
A lot of the stuff
getting built. You know, like if it were in Europe, it wouldn't even get even considered. It would, this person would be flunked out of architecture school. I mean, there's a total lack, not just bad design, but no design. People that have no. You know, I mean, we could go on and on about this subject, but I don't want to drag everybody down too much. But on the positive side, there's enough of the old stuff still extant that people should be aware of how much craft we could be returning to, like what you're doing. I mean, you're doing a thing, a lifestyle, working with your hands, your head, and your heart. You, as an individual, are doing your part in doing, you know, making a better world.
I try to do a good job, and I know that these other guys that are doing signs around here that I know are going to see it, and they call you up and say, oh, I saw that sign you did on Sandy Boulevard, and it kind of, you know, and to keep the quality up. And I guess what I have to say about that is, you know, that it just enhances life for everybody. And, like, those old buildings they're valuable. You can't replace them. Once they're gone. And if people live in Portland and have lived here for years and they're used to walking down Broadway and seeing the Fox Theater, if one day some big corporation wants to put up a, you know, this, what you might use the word, maybe a monoculture-looking high-rise, it sort of leaves people shell-shocked, because these people remember going by the Fox Theater and maybe going there on their fifth birthday party or seeing The Wizard of Oz there or some movie, and that it becomes part of them in a way. It's their environment, because they're no longer in the Redwood Forest or by the river looking at the salmon. So it kind of leaves them like spun, you know, and I see a lot of people look sort of spun in the modern age because we go through so much change.
I think you're onto something.
It just kind of makes them grounded to know that this is a building that was here when my grandfather was here, and, you know, I saw this when I was a child, and my kids will see this, but then all of a sudden somebody tears it down. It's sort of sad, you know.
It's definitely.
You lose a sense of place. You lose a certain identity for the city. And the only another thing I had to say, that I remember a friend of mine said that, you know, it's kind of disrespect for the people who built Portland, because these people are gone.
Absolutely.
They're gone. You'll never be able
to
talk to them. You can't really have a dialogue with them. The only way you can know these people is from what they left behind. And that would be the buildings, the architecture. And if you just destroy that, it's kind of like you're just throwing your history out the window.
Well, I remember one of the most tragic events in my life. When I was a little kid, I remember the Oriental Theater, which was on the east side of the Morrison Bridge somewhere. And it was one of the most gorgeous buildings. It literally was like a European ornate Baroque theater where concerts were playing. It was, of course, torn down. And the other one, which was before, it was torn down in 1952, was the Portland Hotel. And go to the Historical Society and you can see, you know, whole neighborhoods were torn down. Like all of South Portland was razed in the late 50s, early 60s, and 19th Street
was in the four lanes.
Right. But one thing I wanted to add, really,
homogenized culture.
You brought up something that I thought was absolutely so right on. I gotta repeat it, and that is, I think back in when design was happening, like I was thinking about Pietro Belluschi, who was a great architect that lived here, and he claims that his inspiration was mainly going out in the Coast Range and camping for days and weeks on end, and just being informed by the natural world. then taking that natural language back into the studio and then creating beautiful buildings. And I think what's happening now is that everybody is just in front of computer screens, in front of TV sets and their iPods or whatever, and there's a total soullessness, monoculture, nothingness to that. And there's a great, the head guy of XTC, a British new wave band or whatever, was interviewed recently, Andy Partridge, and he said he described the world we live in now as the bland leading the bland. I thought it was like so right on, because I think what I like about what you do and why I want you on the show is that you're a front line, you know, a stand against that way of thinking. And we need more people like you, more people that do handmade, independent, thinking for themselves kind of people, people that don't subscribe to the status quo in any way, shape, or form. And that way it segues with classical left-wing libertarianism. You know, I'm going to do my thing, and you do your thing, and that's the way society should run, as long as you don't harm anybody else. You know what I mean?
It's kind of like vive la différence, you know? I like the idea that, I don't know, like my dad used to say, you know, it takes all kinds of people to make the world, and that makes it interesting. You know, like there's, and just like I'll be working on the street, and somebody would say, how do you do that? Or they'll walk by and say, oh, that's how you do that. And I said, well, that's one of the ways. I mean, there's 10 different ways I could do this.
Right.
So there's not always just one way to do something. And I think it's you know, refreshing. It's interesting to see diversity. They talk, that's a buzzword around this
right. town,
you know, like diversity. But I think, you know, there's, that can be said about doing things in different ways and presenting different ideas that are visual. Because, I mean, we're in this big machine of technology and the city. And, you know, we're not in the wonder of nature where it's ever changing and evolving and each day is different. And, you know, you're in that whole world of kind of wonder. It's, you know, we're in kind of in these time frames and schedules and the grid pattern of the city. So,
right.
You know, I try to make it show that, you know, like hand-painted signs and people that put their passion into something, and it gives the place humanity.
I think that's
something that Portland has to offer that makes it attractive to a lot of people in spite of the weather. And
the very thing that makes it attractive may also destroy it in the sense that it might attract the wrong people who want to come in and make a bunch of money and make, I mean, I remember when.
It's like carpetbaggers in the old South or something.
Right,
they come here with
right.
a dollar sign in their eye. And
I remember when, you know, you could rent a house for $90 a month and now, you know, now you rent a room for $300 a month. And I think one of the things that is
puts pressure on people.
Right,
you know,
it really does.
You don't have time to really enjoy and, you know, take in different aspects of life. You got to keep your, you know, nose to the grindstone, so to speak.
Right.
Money, kind of like a hamster in a wheel, keep those dollars coming in.
All right. Well, I'm afraid that we are going to have to wind this up, Rick. I've just been speaking. This is Tom Kramer substituting for Ava Lake. Thank you, Ava, for letting me on the air. And Rick, thank you so much. It's been great talking to you. This has been Art Focus on KBOO 90.7 FM. Thank you, Rick.
Yeah, this has been good. I appreciate it. And one more thing I'll say. This is for Pete. The rounder the round, the straighter the straight, the better the letter. And if you can't do that, at least spell it right.
All right.
KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM.